When the Maytag plant in Heron, Illinois shut down back in 2006, Gary Spory and nearly 1,000 other workers there faced a choice.
Was going to school next, was finding another job in the area next, or was moving out of the area to find work next.
A recent report shows that downstate Illinois continues to see an exodus of people and businesses as factories close, companies relocate, and skilled young workers move to other big cities. I'm Scott Cameron, stopping the brain drain in downstate Illinois. Plus, we wrap up our series on mental health care.
The first reaction for most people is, oh, were you in the military? And, you know, they seem like, you know, at that moment that they want to thank me for my service. And then I say, no, I wasn't in the military. And people are puzzled. You can see they, and sometimes they'll just flat out ask, and sometimes they won't.
What to say when you don't know what to say? That's coming up on Focus after this news. Good morning. I'm Scott Cameron. Welcome to Focus from Illinois Public Media. Illinois has a people problem. Too many are leaving, and they tend to be the people who are earning more money. As brain drain has been going on for years, it's especially challenging for many downstate communities who've over the years lost factories or other major employers to Chicago and nearby states. In a few minutes, we'll talk about one southern Illinois town that seems to have avoided this fate. And later in the hour, we'll wrap up our series on mental health with an issue that came up during our recent Twitter chat, the evolving language around mental illness. But first, what to do about the downstate Illinois brain drain? If you're considering a move out of downstate Illinois, if you're a company having trouble hiring here, tell us your story. 800-222-9455. Producer Lindsay Moon also is on Twitter. That's at Focus580. And you can email us will-talk@illinois.edu. Pat McDaniel is a city council member in Decatur, nearby here, where just a few months ago ADM announced it was moving its corporate headquarters to Chicago after more than four decades in Decatur. Pat McDaniel joins us now by phone. Pat, welcome to Focus.
Well, good morning, Scott.
So how did you find out that ADM, or at least its global headquarters, was leaving?
Well, we received an invitation from ADM asking us to come to community leaders and council members to come to a luncheon and to hear about the future of ADM, which is, since there had been rumors around for several years with the new CEO, who was really the first outside CEO to come into Decatur, that the corporate headquarters may move up to Chicago. And since Tate and Lyle, who took over, bought out A.E. Staley, moved their headquarters about 2 years ago to Hoffman Estates up near Chicago, you know, you kind of listen to it and you hope, oh, I hope it's not true.
Yeah, so you kind of had an inkling.
Right. So we had our luncheon and they embargoed us as we were seating, having lunch, because they were going to make their announcement to their employees at 1:00. And we had to pledge that we would not leave the table and run to the phone and tell everybody that they were going to be moving their world corporate headquarters out of Decatur.
So they tell you can't leave the table, you can't use your phone. Who's at this table?
Well, we had various community leaders. We did have one media person that was there, and we had the mayor and several council members and economic development people. So there were just a wide variety of community leaders.
It's quite a juxtaposition. You have the leaders in the community, they're being told, no, you stay at the table.
Well,
strange moment.
Yeah, I understand they wanted to tell their employees first before it got into the news, and I can understand that.
Yeah, true. And you said that before that in that moment you reached for a piece of cheesecake. You called it
comfort
food.
You knew something was up, and when they made the announcement, my head dropped down, and I hadn't finished my dessert and a little comfort food of cheesecake.
Yeah.
And, I mean, you didn't know what else to do. I mean, there wasn't anything you could say. And I mean, they even did mention after one of the community leaders said, now, you know, there's going to be community leader groups are going to try to see that you don't move and offer all kinds of incentives. And they were point blank and said, no, you know, we're going to keep our North American headquarters in Decatur. The 4,400 employees that are employed in Decatur with ADM, but we are moving our corporate headquarters, world headquarters, elsewhere. And at that time, they did not say where they were looking at.
Okay. So you've lived in Decatur a long time.
Yes, born and raised and been active in community events and organizations And also, you know, I was a reporter for the Decatur Tribune for 8.5 years.
So you've seen, you know this community, you know this town. Clearly, you love this town. You've been there a long time. This is, you've seen other towns sort of run through this similar type situation. You know what? This must have been hard for you to hear.
Well, it was. Matter of fact, that was a pretty bad week for Decatur. You know, that the announcement was at ADM was at the beginning of the week. And then on the Friday of that same week, which was even to a certain extent a little worse, is that Caterpillar announced they were laying off a number of their white-collar workers at the local Caterpillar plant here, which, although they've never said how many, I've heard kind of about 150 cat people, white-collar. So that kind of almost hurt us more because most of those people lived in Decatur, where, you know, ADM was only going to move about 50 of their key people up to their new corporate headquarters, and not all of those people lived in Decatur. So that was a double whammy week on Decatur. But we're a very resilient community. We've had our ups and downs like many other communities, and we just say, okay, this was the issue. Now we move on and see where we can progress from there.
So what is Decatur doing now to progress from there?
Well, again, one of the key factors that ADM has been building, if you've been hearing about the inland port, this is utilizing the three world-class or country-class railroads that come into Decatur and utilize them, and they built an inland port, not only for their own shipping needs, but now it's open for any variety of shippers and companies throughout the Midwest. You know, we're looking at, we're within, 100 million people within, about 10 hours of Decatur, which is great. So, again, this is a real game changer for Decatur. It's an opportunity to be utilized by many companies. We're hoping some distribution companies will be set up here in the to take advantage of that facility and bring some new jobs. So we're doing that's a key element. We're also making sure that our infrastructure, our basic infrastructure, is being improved and built, because if you're going to keep your present industry, any city, you have to make sure your basic infrastructure is in good shape. And other companies looking at your community have to make sure that you're going to have the infrastructure to meet their needs.
Yeah, to try to attract new talent, new companies, things like that into town.
Right.
Michael Lucci is Director of Jobs and Growth for the Illinois Policy Institute, a research group that focuses on free market ideas. He's been analyzing a lot of the data on people and companies leaving Illinois and downstate Illinois in particular. Michael joins us now on the phone. Michael, nice to talk to you.
It's nice to talk to you, too.
So you've heard Pat McDaniel there talking about the situation in Decatur. We've seen similar stories play out across Illinois. How common is Decatur's experience there in terms of a decline in business and population, and as he was talking about before, high earners specifically?
Decatur's situation is actually quite normal in Illinois. Most of the industrial counties of Illinois have lost population and lost income to other parts of Illinois and, more importantly, to other states in the country. So Decatur has had a net loss of people and income, both to Cook County, but also to the rest of America. But what's important to us in this discussion is that Illinois itself is losing a lot of people to other states in the country. We lose people to almost every state on net. And what I mean by that is, when you take the number of people who move from, say, Illinois to Indiana, and you find the difference with people who move from Indiana to Illinois, Illinois is losing that net exchange every year for the past 20 years. So what we want to look at is ways to make the state of Illinois more competitive, more attractive to businesses such as ADM, which has been in Illinois for a long time, but also small businesses, large businesses that want to grow here. We want them to feel that this is a place that will foster their growth.
Yeah, so looking at the towns, as people do start to fade away from some of these places, how does that kind of loss of people and then that income affect a town?
It's devastating for those kind of towns. And I have to say, I can sympathize specifically with Decatur. I'm originally from a place called Youngstown, Ohio, which is known as America's fastest shrinking city. We peaked out in the 60s and 70s and have been declining since.
Was that the Firestone plant?
Youngstown was a steel city.
Okay.
Firestone was us.
Okay. All right.
But these cities are faced with a number of problems. One of the problems that's popping up in the last 10 years is their pension problems. These municipalities have promises to pay pensions to city workers and teachers, and they're losing population. They're losing taxpayers to fund those things. So the problem is building upon itself as more financial obligations are coming due. The people we need to pay those obligations are leaving. They're leaving for other parts of Illinois, and they're leaving for other states in the country.
And that gets at another point here, that the Midwest in general, Illinois in particular, has trouble holding on to college graduates. And some of these, you know, high-paying, skilled fields, technology comes to mind, healthcare, things like that. How does that play into this?
Sure. We lose a lot of highly skilled workers, and that's referenced in the income of those workers. Every single year, we've lost more people than we've gained, and every single year, the average income of someone who leaves has been higher than the average income of the people who come in. The average difference is nearly $10,000 a year. So these net losses really compound. The state has lost a total of $40 billion of annual income, and that is income that would be taxed at the state and local level, which for Illinois on the whole is about 10%. So that's about $4 billion of state revenue that we lose every single year.
And if you're losing some of the younger, more skilled, higher paid in some case workers, do we see then that the people who are staying may be older, may use more health type resources, may rely more on the pension benefits and things like that, so you have this, you're not able to fund some of those needs later on?
Yes, we see a lot of tech workers moving to California, which on the whole is not the most business-friendly environment, but they still have a lot of good things happening in Silicon Valley that attracts a lot of tech workers. University of Illinois is one of has a great, you know, tech and engineering graduate programs, and they lose about 80% of their graduates to other states. A lot of that goes to Silicon Valley. But we're also seeing that the state that's really attracting a lot of our talent right now is Texas. In the most recent year of IRS data, Texas took more people than any other state in the country, and Florida and Indiana were other states that really pulled a lot of Illinois' talent.
And why those states?
Texas specifically and Florida also are zero-income tax states, which really promotes jobs growth. And if we look at somewhere like Decatur, if we look at other cities like Peoria that have very high jobless rates, Rockford, these cities all have double-digit jobless rates. So people have to go where there is opportunity, and there is tremendous opportunity in Texas. They've been growing jobs every month. The Great Recession, which hit Illinois very hard, was almost little more than a blip in Texas. They continued growing jobs. As soon as the recession ended, they started growing more and more jobs. And I hear every week from people who used to live in Illinois and have since moved their business to Texas or just moved their family to Texas because it's easier to do business there. They're taxed much more lightly and they're regulated much more lightly there.
Do we know, I mean, thinking about Texas and Florida, I know Arizona is on the list where a lot of people from Illinois go. These are also Sunbelt states where a lot of people go to retire, often retirees at the end of their career, also high earners.
Sure.
Do we know what measure of this at this point? I mean, the data can be tough to read. How many of these people are going to moving for a friendly environment, and how many are going and saying, hey, I want to be somewhere sunny when I retire?
It's because of taxpayer confidentiality, we can't get into the very granular things in the IRS data. They won't release specifics like that.
Okay.
But we know that Illinois loses people to 43 of the 50 states, so it's not just the Sun Belt. As I said, one of our big losses is to Indiana. Mm-hmm. They have the exact same weather that we have, but they have a very different business climate.
Yeah.
And in human terms, Illinois is losing one person every 10 minutes to these other states.
Wow. And this is not something, you said this is not something new. This is not something that's just been since, the downturn, the recession. This has been going on a while.
Right. Actually, the recession slowed it down, because if you think about what happened during the recession, home prices plummeted. So if you're someone who wants to move to take this new opportunity in Atlanta or in Dallas or somewhere like that, when your home price is cut in half, that's not the time when you move. What we're seeing is that as the rest of the country bounces back and as Illinois' housing market bounce back, those out-migration numbers are increasing again. So the most recent estimate from the Census Bureau is we lost between 60 and 70,000 people on net in the 2012 to 2013 year.
So people are more mobile as things bounce back a little bit.
Yes.
We're talking about the brain drain, how to stop it in Illinois in general and downstate Illinois specifically. Pat McDaniel on the line, City Councilman in Decatur, and the voice you just heard, Michael Lucci, Director of Jobs and Growth for the Illinois Policy Institute. Pat McDaniel, coming back to you and looking at Decatur specifically, we've covered a couple of broad topics here. Thinking about attracting young people to some of these places, some of these communities, including in Decatur, do young people in town see opportunity for themselves in Decatur right now, or are they leaving for bigger cities?
I think Decatur and many other communities in Illinois never had a problem keeping our young professionals in the past. But when you lose the number of industries and management jobs in a community like Decatur, of course the young professionals are going to be moving out. Michael was talking about tech companies. I just heard the other day on Business News where a tech company located in the Silicon Valley is moving their headquarters to San Francisco so they could attract more young professionals. So it's even happening there. And I think Michael will say, on the history of migration, look in the 40s and 50s when massive people moved from the South up to, the Rust Belt. At that time, it wasn't the Rust Belt,
right,
to find jobs. And now the migration is going reversing. Their companies are moving their factories down into the South because of lower costs and, right-to-work states.
I want to look ahead. In a few minutes, we're going to talk with somebody from Herrin, Illinois, which found through a number of different ways to stem this tide of people out. So I want to talk about some solutions, too. But as I hear you talk, Pat, and I know there's a lot of things that are going on in Decatur right now, pushing things forward, and we can revisit some of those things, too. But as I hear you talk, are you concerned about the future of Decatur?
Well, I'm always optimistic, but I'm realistic with the economy. I think we've got some great companies. One of the issues I think many communities are finding is we have the jobs down here. If we had the employees, we have a great Millikan University and Richland Community College that is in the forefront of training people that the companies need. But that's an issue, the education issue. When you have a graduation rate of in Decatur, it's around 60%. And if they're not going to graduate from high school, they're certainly not going to go on. Majority of them are not going to go on and go to a community college and get the skills and the trades they need that the companies need.
Yeah.
So, for instance, if I've heard this on many commentary recently, if a company would come to Decatur and want 2,000 employees, it'd be pretty tough to find those employees.
Yeah,
and not only education,
levels,
but it's the old, can you pass a drug test? And that is being taken up by a lot of companies. They have a call for employees. They come in, fill out applications, and then when they say, "Well, come back the next day for a drug test," well, a lot of people won't come back. And this just isn't a Decatur problem. This is a problem throughout the country.
So, what's driving that?
Pardon?
What's driving the it sounds like you're describing a growing drug problem. In the
well,
town, right?
I think it is. It's been on national news. I just think it's, I went to a town meeting last night about keeping young people off being drunk in that. Well,
mm-hmm.
Most employees, potential employees are going to a company for interviews. They're not drunk, but they could have been on drugs the last 2 or 3 weeks. It's still in their system. So,
And certainly we've seen a meth problem and a growing heroin problem in Central Illinois.
We need to address that, and I really don't know how to do it. I mean,
To speak to that point, one of the things Illinois can do is work on a more innovative education system. I recently spoke to the head of the Illinois Technology Association, and he said the number one thing Illinois will need to attract tech companies is tech-savvy workers, so people who can do coding, people who can do digital programming, which is not a part of the high school curriculum in Illinois, in Chicago, in anywhere here. So if we had more choice in education, more innovation in education, we could bring up those skills that would allow us to attract the companies, because we would have the workforce who could work for those companies.
And Michael, you're exactly right. There was a recent Wall Street article that they did a survey of educators and of businesses, and 95% of educators said they were meeting the needs of the future for businesses, and only 86% of businesses that took part in the survey said that our educational system is meeting the needs for the businesses. So there's a big disconnect there. And I'm glad Michael brought that up.
Yeah, and on a similar topic, we got a couple of tweets in from Lisa on Twitter at Focus580. She says, I realize Champaign-Urbana isn't Decatur, but we lose people here too. There are grads who can't get jobs, U of I or medical complexes. And she says, in her humble opinion, high-speed internet like Google Fiber is going to be a game changer in towns like this. Michael, what do you think of that?
Well, Champaign has lost nearly $1 billion of income to net migration, and they've lost nearly 6,000 taxpayers to other counties. I think that having the skills through education will be very important, and being able to keep those U of I grads down there will be very important to that community.
Okay. There was a report that came up. I want to check with you, Michael Lucci, on this just briefly here. We're running a little short on time, but one report referenced a shift from smokestack chasing, it called it, among states to people chasing, meaning more states are looking to attract skilled workers specifically in some of these training programs and education programs rather than offering incentives to companies to attract them or keep them. Does one, in your view, work better than the other?
Well, certainly having a more educated and skilled workforce, I think, works best. Illinois has a reputation for chasing companies with tax incentives, and as a whole, we don't see that as a positive policy decision, because in order to cut one group's taxes to give them a special tax cut, that has to be financed by the rest of the companies and the rest of the workers in the state. Research shows that chasing companies with special tax breaks isn't the best way to get them. It is to just have a general, fair, level playing field with low taxation, low regulation, and, as you're saying, a highly skilled workforce. That's what companies are looking for. Companies will take, and in Illinois we see, they line up in Springfield asking for their handouts. Even though many of these companies have billions in profits, they still get handouts from Springfield. That doesn't keep the business community on a whole happy. It keeps the winners happy. The losers, of course, are going to be unhappy. And recent polls from Gallup support this. Illinois has the lowest confidence in government of any state in the country, and it's actually not even close.
Coming back to Decatur and Pat McDaniel, city councilman there, also a lifelong resident of Decatur, and on the issue of tax incentive, there were several state legislators from the Decatur area who said, you know, no, we shouldn't be giving them, you know, in some cases, if they're going to be moving out of that area, some of these incentives. But ADM is promising millions of dollars to Decatur in the coming years. Pat, how much of a difference is that going to be?
Well, again, they're keeping their North American headquarters here with the 4,400 employees. ADM is still committed to Decatur. They just announced yesterday that they're giving $2 million worth of grants to 75 organizations within Decatur. So, you know, ADM still has a commitment here, and we certainly appreciate ADM, and Tate & Lyle still has major manufacturing here, although, you know, again, their key executives are up in the Hoffman Estates area. We have Caterpillar, and unfortunately, if you just saw the recent financial report by CAT, they moved our major road grader line from Decatur, it's been here since 1955, down to Arkansas, a right-to-work state. So that really hurt us there, but they've invested like $300 million in the production of the mining truck, which, when it's going gangbusters, that's great. But with mining sales down 46% in the world, and I think it's 80% on the mining truck. You know, we're in a kind of thin ice on what's going to happen in the future. Again, they're committed to us, and we're committed to CAT and the other companies in Decatur to see what we can do to help them as much as possible. I agree with Michael. Many states and communities really have to watch these incentives. You can just pour money in it, but what's the major return?
Yeah, a bit of a double-edged sword.
You have to really be selective on how you do that.
So clearly Decatur, like many other cities, faces some challenges, but this is not a one-company town.
No.
You see diversity there. You see companies stepping up. You see continued involvement from ADM and others. When you talked about sort of the infrastructure and some other things going on there, are you seeing at this point signs of those working, of that rebuilding, of streets sort of coming back?
Well, streets and again, water. I always say that the next wars will be fought over water, not oil. And we have a Decatur, Lake Decatur, which is a man-made lake. It's been needing to have been dredged. We have started it, but we just announced, we voted several weeks ago on an $89 million project of dredging that will supply an additional 30% capacity for that lake to handle the needs of not only ADM and Tate & Lyle and other industries, but maybe, again, that's a major economic development a factor for other companies looking at Decatur. So we are moving forward. Again, as Michael said, money. When you have a population shrinking, there's less revenue coming in, and fortunately there's less economic grants coming from the federal and state government. So there's some balancing of your basic community services and meet the needs of industry.
All right, well, Pat McDaniel, a city councilman there in Decatur, thank you very much for talking with us, and good luck.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Michael Lucci, Director of Jobs and Growth for the Illinois Policy Institute, also joining us here by phone. Michael, thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
And another town, I mentioned it just a few minutes ago, in recent years that faced the loss of a major employer, in this case, Maytag. In the end, it thrived. Herrin is in southern Illinois, where Kathy Lively joins us now. She's CEO of a company called MantraCon. It's a nonprofit that, among other things, helped laid off workers in that town find jobs, connect them with education, other things like that. Kathy, welcome to Focus.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So you've heard the conversation and some of what's been going on. This is something that played out specifically in Herrin. In 2006, Maytag laid off, I think it was about 1,000 workers at the Herrin plant, about 12,000 people, a population for the town there. How did that affect people at the time?
As you would expect, it was extremely devastating. The good news the silver lining in all of that was that they did give us 6 months' notice. And so it was actually a whirlpool decision to consolidate their efforts out of our state. But it was at a time when the buyout wasn't even complete between Whirlpool and Maytag. So our workers were also faced with severance benefits decisions that needed to be made with Maytag. At the same time, they found out they were losing the job from the newly acquired company, the company who had newly acquired them in terms of being Whirlpool. So it was a very confusing situation for them.
And when the plant closed, I read that the mayor said that he feared kind of a mass exodus from the city, a declining tax base, essentially the town kind of fading away. That's not what happened. What did happen?
Well, I think it's really important to understand that we, in this instance, may have the benefit of being a smaller community. And when you're a smaller community, you still have a lot of that old kind of country, rural America backbone and attitude that we are all in this together. And so I believe from the very beginning, from the rainy, drizzly, gray day that the announcement was made at City Hall until the workers actually were given their kind of final exit from the plant 2 days before Christmas, I think throughout all of that time, the community rallied together. We created a transition team. We determined that we were going to look at this as an opportunity to retrain our workforce through the Public Workforce Investment System, and we were going to make this work for our workers. But it was a very personal, one-on-one decision to work with the people who were being affected and in their entire life, not just the loss of job, not just retraining, but the impact it had on the entire family. So I think in this instance, it was a determination by a group of very dedicated people that we were going to serve the entire family and that we were all in this together.
Well, I know that Mantricon, your company, played a big role in that. What other types? I mean, you said the community kind of came together. Can you give some examples?
Sure. And the Southern Illinois Workforce Investment Board is the actual entity that handles the Workforce Investment Act funds, and we're very proud as a small not-for-profit to be their administrative entity. And because of our outreach in the communities, we had both state and local elected officials on this transition team. We had social services, including behavioral health. We had healthcare entities that were part of our transition team, our community colleges, our Southern Illinois University at Carbondale, community action agencies who had LIHEAP or energy assistance and rent assistance funds. We had financial advisors. It was really a total look at the community. Area mayors, the ministerial alliance was key because a lot of their interactions in their churches ended up being and understanding that this was a transition period for the workers and the community as well.
And the mayor had told USA Today a few years back that, you know, companies, local companies, small businesses hired workers they didn't necessarily need. There was a professional clothes closet where people could come if they didn't have interview clothes and still look professional without being able without having to buy it. That the police got emergency numbers, I think, from Mantricon specifically.
Yes.
You know, if workers got in trouble or seemed, you know, even suicidal at some point, that people would step in and know what to do.
And that, again, goes to that idea, that concept that we were going to solve this larger system issue one worker at a time. We were present, myself included, at all of the shift changes for months to pass out flyers and to talk to people about opportunities. And, you know, it wasn't easy for us because we were kind of considered to be the suits, you know. And
you were the bad guys almost.
Well, and we couldn't possibly understand the line workers' position, you know, the manufacturing environment. And so I think it helped that I had worked at the facility at one time. I remember the first day that the collective bargaining unit there called all of the workers together at one of our elementary schools, and there were 1,000 people sitting, well, more than that, because they brought spouses and significant others. And I was given a few moments to speak to the group. It was a very, very difficult thing to do, but I had to convince them. I felt like personally, I went to school with many of them, coached in baseball teams, served with them on committees. I just had to convince them that this was going to be about each one of them individually, and we were going to devote time to each one of them individually, and we would help them get through this transition.
And being from the town, having lived in the town for a long time, you had some of that insight, too.
I did. And I always wore, you know, I wore clothes that would be, that the workers would be comfortable around for the most part. I never dressed in a suit when I went to talk with them.
Yeah. So now, that was 2006. Now, years later, the population is leveled. There was really no exodus at all. Unemployment seems stable. Businesses along Main Street seem, you know, to have come back if they ever really went away in the first place. It makes me wonder. You mentioned earlier that, you know, Heron being a small town, that was an advantage for them. Do you think a model like this type of a town-wide effort and even other towns stepping in to do this, could this work elsewhere in a larger town, a more diverse community? Could that model work elsewhere?
Absolutely. I think that what the key for us was in from the very beginning talking about this to our workers about it being a transition instead of an end, you know, and of course they went through all the stages of grief that one would expect, and so there was anger. I'm not saying that we had easy days, but I think the fact that in their churches, if they went to church, people were talking about it in the bars. There were posters and flyers up about where they could go for help. We had a community prayer day that was sponsored by the city and the hospital that also was going through an expansion mode at the time there in the town. So I just think everywhere they looked, grocery stores were wonderful, our Walmart, where we had a silver ribbon campaign, trying to turn this terrible event and look for the silver lining, looking at it as an opportunity to have training funds to go back and do something else. And so I do think it would work anywhere psychologically to understand that the whole community cares about them and what's happening to them as people. I do believe it would work anywhere.
And now 7-8 years later, do you think that the work is done?
Oh, I think the work is ongoing. Over 500 of our workers actually went back to some kind of post-secondary education training, and the average age of those workers was 50. So, you know, we didn't have in that particular instance a young group. And so convincing them through opportunity fairs about education that they could actually be a successful college student was one of our first hurdles. And technology, I heard you talking earlier about technology, was definitely a barrier because many of them had never even been on Facebook or interacted in a technology manner. So we had lots of computer workshops and internet workshops in our environment with their coworkers where they were comfortable. So it was kind of identifying the potential hurdles before even the workers understood them and bringing resources to those hurdles.
And sort of solving, it sounds like multiple pieces to this puzzle. There was no single thing that really made the difference. There were the efforts of many coming together, it sounds like, in one
correct.
One
and our employers, when we had an employment opportunity fair, you know, we had over 200 employers. And for our region, that's very significant. And even if they weren't hiring that moment, what was critically important was they would say to the workers, again, because they all had been coached, they were part of this transition, here's what our company looks for. So if you go back and retrain, here's what we look for. And we would love to have you as part of our team, and we expect to be hiring in 6 months or 8 months. It gave the workers a feeling that even if right this minute there isn't something for me, if I just go back and pick up XYZ training, there's an opportunity for me because now I know what this company's looking for.
Yeah, well, Kathy Lively, a CEO of Mantracon, lives in Heron, Illinois. I thank you very much for your time and good luck.
You're very welcome. Thank you, sir.
And up next, the language surrounding mental illness continues to evolve over time. We'll talk about some of the challenges that that poses. Stay with us. It's Focus on Illinois Public Media. Welcome back to Focus on Illinois Public Media. I'm Scott Cameron. All this month, we've looked at a number of the challenges surrounding getting mental health care in central Illinois. We wrap up that series later today. As part of the series a few weeks ago, we hosted a Twitter chat on the topic. Many of you shared experiences, and a number of questions came up, too. One of the issues that arose in that Twitter chat was the language that we use to describe mental illness. Dan Jay tweeted at us, said that a friend's therapist complains whenever she calls herself crazy as a term. Lisa tweeted, I never know exactly the right correct terminology when talking about mental illness. She says, I don't want to offend. So that's where we'll spend the remaining time of the show today. Joey Ramp knows how powerful language can be when it comes to mental illness. She joins us now by phone. Joey, welcome to the show. Thanks for talking to us.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, good morning. Now, you have PTSD. You talk about this. You're fairly open about it. What happens when you share that information with people who don't already know you?
Well, you know, that's not the first thing I say when I meet someone, but I do have a service dog, and my disability is relatively invisible, so people are curious. And at times they will ask, whether I'm in a college setting or out socially. And usually, you know, when I first say that I have PTSD, their first response is they assume that I've been in the military.
Mm-hmm.
And they, you know, generally want to thank me for my service and such. But I've never served in the military. My PTSD is not due to a military-related trauma.
But they make that assumption.
Yes, they automatically make that assumption. And, you know, generally, then they're even more curious. And at times they will ask, you know, well, if you weren't in the military, I don't understand why you have PTSD. I thought that was just military related. And then I've made a choice. I've gotten to a point in my recovery where I am trying to educate people. So I am forthcoming when I speak, and I tell them, no, my PTSD is related to childhood sexual trauma and domestic abuse. And that's when the conversation generally gets very awkward.
And it's almost, making that assumption almost seems to, in a way, try to devalue your own experience. Do you take it that way?
Can you repeat that, please?
Sure. Just as making an assumption, sort of that confusion that comes up after they hear, okay, you have PTSD, you must have served in the military. Mm-hmm. You say, well, no, you know, my experience was different. And then there's this kind of this awkward moment you just described of confusion and not understanding that, and that doesn't make sense to them. You know, it almost strikes me as, in a way, devaluing your experience is the message that's being sent there. Do you sense that?
Yes, absolutely. That is something. You know, people don't understand that you know, PTSD can come from any type of trauma, whether it's sexual abuse, domestic abuse, being in a car accident, witnessing a violent crime, the statistics for PTSD occurrences of youth children is 50%, and military veterans are 30%. You know, there's a lot of overlapping there with domestic abuse and rape adults and firefighters and policemen and things like that. But PTSD is not just military. It's got a wide spectrum of traumas. And I don't think that many people understand that. For someone who has experienced a severe trauma in their life, the brain internalizes that, and it alters the brain chemicals. And that's how PTSD develops over time. Unfortunately, people with long-term traumas like combat or domestic abuse or, someone who's experienced extended, rape or kidnapping or something, then that becomes a process in their brain that just keeps repeating and repeating, and it actually alters the brain chemicals. I would like people to know that, there are so many people out there who suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder, and they need to be able to talk about it. They need to be able to feel like they are supported. And, someone who's experienced rape, someone who's experienced domestic abuse, or, a natural disaster, someone who experiences military trauma, all of those traumas can be debilitating. And they can alter someone's life. And, the symptoms are the same, but all of our nightmares are maybe different, and our experiences are different, and our triggers are different. But ultimately, the symptoms can be just as debilitating for someone from another form of trauma as someone with a military-related trauma.
Right. And you actually just kind of answered by my last question here. I was going to, so what do you wish people would know from that experience? But Joey Ramp, thank you so much for sharing your story. I think we often find that, in doing this series on mental health here over the last month, people often will tell us that by sharing the story, they are able to sort of reach other people and help other people, and that often makes a big difference. So Joey Ramp, thank you very much for your time today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Kate White joins us now. She's Associate Professor of Behavioral Science at Millikan University. Kate, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you.
First of all, and is that a common experience to have people jump to conclusions when they find out somebody has, in this case, PTSD, but really any mental illness?
Yes, I believe it is. I think likely that the jump now to a person with a service dog having PTSD and being part of the military is due to the increased awareness of our servicemen coming home with PTSD and some of the treatments that are being offered to them. So the communication or the media has been very specific about problems that our military men are experiencing and what some of the treatments are. I don't think we as a society have been as educated on other forms of mental health issues or other PTSDs as well as we have our military most recently. So I think sometimes the layperson can jump and think, okay, now I heard that on the radio, I heard that on the TV, and then they think, oh, well, PTSD, military. I think probably their reaction is trying to be supportive, but they are then taken back because they're in unfamiliar territory, and possibly, as Joey said, we're unaware of PTSD coming from other sources.
Yeah, I think you hit something important there, that people, that awkwardness that we're talking about that launched this conversation, some of the things we heard on Twitter, it comes from a place of people wanting to help, wanting to know what to say, and just not knowing that.
Right. And as I thought about this more, I feel that's pretty symbolic of our society's non-knowledge about mental health issues. If you had a neighbor whose son had an acute appendicitis attack and was raced to the hospital one evening, you might go next door to your neighbor and say, oh, my goodness, I see your son was taken to the hospital. How are things going? If I can let out your dog, if I can do something, just call me. I'm here.
Mm-hmm.
Because we as a society have been socialized to know what to do with, quote-unquote, medical illnesses. but we haven't been socialized on how to respond appropriately to mental health issues. And because we separate mental health issues from quote-unquote medical issues, we make it awkward on ourselves.
Yeah, and I mean, it is hard. I even think when I was talking to Joey, you know, is there a moment, do I say, well, I'm sorry that that happened? Do I say, you know, I didn't know what to say?
Absolutely, and it's because we learn our social skills from our families and our parents and those in the community around us. And mental health awareness really hasn't been, we don't have a long history of mental health awareness in our society. It really started in the 60s. It happened before then, but it wasn't common talk until the 60s or the 70s.
What changed there?
Well, policy-wise in the United States, President Kennedy, and then with his life shortened, President Johnson, started the conversations on community health treatment, mental health treatment, and the deinstitutionalization of people that had mental health and some other types of behavioral or developmental problems. They brought that topic out of the closet. Prior to the 60s, many times someone that had a mental health problem or even a developmental disability was institutionalized. They weren't seen as people to be part of traditional society.
So not only were these issues not talked about, the people who were affected by those issues were hidden.
Yes, they were hidden away in large institutions. And that started to be torn down with Kennedy. He had personal issues in his own family of mental health, depression, suicide attempts, alcohol and drug issues in his family. And I think he had an aunt that had Down syndrome. And so he started the conversation of bringing these issues out and made it okay to talk about. And then after his death, Lyndon Johnson and his Great Society Plan and the development of the Community Mental Health Center movement followed through with that. So it started the conversation, but we have a lot of years of misunderstanding of mental health issues and our knowledge. We know so much more medically about appendicitis or gastroenteritis than we do mental health diagnoses and causes. Mm-hmm. We're still learning about the brain.
So there's still a long way to go, both in terms of perceptions and the knowledge, it sounds like, of what
yes.
we know and understand.
And we were told socially, you know, don't look, don't ask, don't talk.
Mm-hmm. And that's
because that's rude. That's rude.
Right. And that's a hard habit to break.
It is. But these are people, and they have an issue, an illness, something that they're working on, and we care about them. And so you say, I really don't understand much about that, but I'm sure glad your dog helps you.
So don't be afraid to say, look, I don't know what to do here. I don't know the perfect thing to say.
Exactly.
But I want you to know I care.
Yes. I think that is something that is helpful in so many situations when you don't know what to say.
Yeah. Now, coming back to what launched this conversation was a couple of comments on Twitter, one involving the word crazy. In this case, he described somebody who was seeing a therapist and often called herself crazy, and the therapist said, you know, don't do that. That's a loaded term.
It's a very loaded term with many, many negative connotations for that person, and that's kind of a label our society when people do not act as we want them to act. Sometimes we label them. They're crazy. They're hyper. They're out of it. They're bonkers. And so people start to feel different, isolated, alone, and very negative about themselves. It's very negative self-talk and self-projection. It's not helpful to anyone.
Yeah. And we've got about a minute left here, but just looking at some of the other terms that come up, you know, in the series that we're doing, you talked about media coverage earlier. You know, we often see in headlines and in news stories and things like that, we try to be very aware of it, the word suffer related to mental illness.
Mm-hmm.
How does that strike you?
The word suffer?
The word suffer is in terms of mental illness. It's been described as implying that there is suffering when some people will say, you know what, no, I've learned to live and thrive with this. I am not suffering from this. This does not own me.
Many forms of mental illness can be a lifetime management issue, such as diabetes. Okay,
mm-hmm.
Let's just draw a parallel there. someone that has diabetes is always going to have to manage their diet and their exercise and their weight. And sometimes they'll have, even in their best attempts, they're going to have a setback with their blood sugar and they're going to need some attention and some work. And you might say at that time they're suffering the side effects of their illness. That doesn't diminish them. That doesn't make them a lesser person. But do they suffer from having chronic diabetes? It depends on your definition of suffering. Again, suffering is kind of a loaded word.
Mm-hmm.
But I do believe that at times people managing their mental health issues do have periods where they are uncomfortable, unhappy, feel bad. And if you would like to label that suffering, I think that's appropriate.
Yeah, it's not one thing that... Oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
But you don't suffer every day, 24 hours a day. As if you're in your last stages of terminal cancer.
Right. And that's one thing I guess I'm learning here from this conversation as well, is the series that we've done, is in many ways, you know, not labeling other people, allow them to determine their own words that describe their experience rather than trying to plaster them with your own perceptions.
Absolutely. And just, I mean, they're people. Talk with them.
Right, you know? Exactly. Just like a broken leg, if somebody fell down, you'd say,
yeah.
Hey, you doing okay? A similar kind of thing.
Yeah, what happened to your leg? You know, if we see someone with a prosthesis on the street, we do not assume they were military.
Right.
Okay.
Well, Kay White, we're going to have to leave it there. We're just short on time here.
Kay
White
fine.
Is Associate Professor in the Behavioral Sciences Department at Millikan University. Joined us today on the phone. Thank you very much. It was nice to talk to you.
You're welcome, and thank you.
All right. Jason Croft is Focus's Technical Director. Ryan Weber is our intern. And for one final day, Lindsay Moon is Focus's producer, one of the smartest, most creative producers I've ever worked with. She's the one who makes this show succeed day in and day out, and after today she'll be heading back home to Iowa Public Radio, at least for now. Lindsay, thank you for guiding Focus these past 2 years, for bringing an energy and a new perspective to our newsroom, for making me a better host. I was lucky to have you back. Good luck. We're going to miss you. I'm Scott Cameron. This is Focus on Illinois Public Media.